Welcome to the Ritual House Podcast, a show about the rituals we practice, the new ones we create, and the many ways rituals help us live deeper, more meaningful, and more connected lives. I'm your host, Tova Leibovic Douglas, and allow me to be the first one to say, welcome home. I am so glad to have you back at the Ritual House. We made it through the eclipse season, although we're kind of at the tail end of it. Mercury is definitely in retrograde. And if none of this means anything to you, then I'll do a little explanation on it. But I'll say that, like, this is really powerful, potent energy to work with. To work with, to hide away from, whatever it is you want to say. But we are really in this moment in time that is a lot. It's a lot energetically. There's a lot of energy. I mean, anyone that was out and about on the eclipse day earlier this week could feel, like, as my friend said, she was like, it's like the children all had caffeine this morning. There was like a frenetic energy and excitement in the air. It's kind of cool actually to see people collectively really eager and excited to see the eclipse. And also just energetically, people are wired in a particular way. I've been feeling it for a long time, but it really felt like it came to a head this week. In particular, while Mercury is in retrograde, which means basically like the planet that rules communication, it's like a little bit away from us right now, which means communication can be a little difficult. This really impacts my particular chart. And anytime I start losing things, which I do, anytime I like things don't work, like I can't sign up for something or my internet goes down or recording this podcast right now, the platform that I use was down for a few minutes. Like anytime that happens, I'm like, why is this happening? And then I look and I'm like, oh, Mercury's in retrograde. So some of us are more impacted than others on it. I'm not an astrologer. I just like astrology a lot. And I particularly love to combine typical astrology with also looking at Jewish astrological norms and our lunar calendar. So that is something that I love to do. You are welcome to join us. I'm offering virtual sit-ins for that once a month around the new moon, as well as offering in-person opportunities to engage with that in experiential ways. And I'd love to see you at one of our events for the Ritual House. DM me if you have any questions. Sign up for our Substack so you get the latest and greatest. And the offering really is for us to sit with the energies that are at play in the world, to find ourselves within those. How do we step into the energy? How do we lean into it? How do we reflect and be self-reflective as human beings, utilizing some beautiful ancient wisdom that I think our ancestors really held for us? I want to lift that up from the Jewish perspective, as well as integrate other perspectives, which I think arguably is what we have done historically forever. This episode today is a good one. My friend and sound editor, Eli Unger Sargon, you'll get to know him and his contrarian views in the world and his depth and care and love for humanity and for beings. There's like a lot of compelling moments through this episode. It made me think a lot. And I'll say that, like, it's an episode that could be a little triggering, little T triggering. We talk a lot. The focus really is on one ritual and one ritual that's really, really can be complicated, especially for Eli. That ritual being Brit Milah, Bris, or circumcision, right? So we talk about that and asking the bigger questions. What do you do when there's an ancient ritual that has been handed down to us? What do you do if it doesn't align anymore for you personally? And he brings his unique perspective on this. And I have said from the beginning, the Ritual House is not a monolith of views. It is a house that can hold the multitudes, the multiple truths, the multiple pathways, and that there is not one way to do any of this. I actually want that to be dismantled because it does not work for us anymore. It has not worked historically, but it's really coming to a head at this point. So I invited him on to share his own experience and his own research and the organization that he helped start. I know that this topic can be really hard for people, so just listen to this episode with care for yourself. Ellie's awesome. I hope you enjoy. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to the Ritual House. I am so happy to be here today with my guest. Eliyahu grew up in an Orthodox Jewish family in Brookline, Massachusetts. At age 13, he and his family moved to Israel. Eliyahu decided not to serve in the IDF, Israel Defense Forces, choosing instead to study medicine in the UK. 3 years into his degree, he left medicine to pursue a career in film. After earning 2 degrees from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, Eliyahu completed his first feature-length documentary, Cut, Slicing Through the Myths of Circumcision. He has since released his second feature-length documentary, A People Without a Land, and is co-host of the podcast Four Cubits, as well as Bruchim. We have known one another for almost 10 years, or maybe 10 years, even longer than 10 years. We met through the Newground Fellowship, which you've met a couple people on this podcast already that have been part of this fellowship, Muslim-Jewish Partnership for Change. And I will say my first impression of Ellie was one of, we will never be friends. And here we are 10 years later. He is not only a great sound editor for The Ritual House, which is why it sounds so great, and for our last podcast, Not Your Jewish Mother, but he is also just has become a really great friend and a really good person to think through some really, like, the hardest of hard conversations or things to think about in our day, which is a challenging day. He is at the front line doing that on his own island and is a willing partner to do that with other people. And I think what I admire the most about him is his willingness to just go into the hard, the challenge, and to do so from a place of really wanting discourse and conversation and really to get to a place where we're having real conversations. So I'm really grateful that first impressions are not the lasting impressions always. And I'm really grateful for the gifts that you bring to the world. I'm really glad you're here, Ellie. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Tova. It's a real honor to be here on the podcast. You know, who runs this show? This is, you know, what's going on here? The editor's a guest. I don't know what to say, but I am deeply honored, especially in the esteemed company that I find myself now being a part of, the Ritual House. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here. You know, it's funny. I actually wanted to have you on for a while in my head. And I was like, well, I'll do a second season. It's kind of actually what I've done in my head for a lot of people that I'm close with on my, like, day-to-day life.
Yep.
For the most part, I've been like, oh, I'll have them on the second season. The first season, I'm going to just, like, try, you know, to get the people or what that I don't know as well, you know?
Yeah. Shoot for the stars.
Yeah. And I mean, there have been so many stars, you know, and you're a star too. It's not to say that you're not a star. It's just to say that it's a lot more convenient to be like, hey, what are you doing? Can you record? You know, it's a little easier.
Totally.
I'm really grateful you're here. I think that what is really interesting about what I want to talk about today, and I'm hopeful you'll go there because there's so many different topics we can talk about. The two of us talk offline all the time about lots of different topics.
Yes, we do.
But, like, we have to talk about ritual today because we're on The Ritual House. One of our favorite questions at The Ritual House to start us off is...
I knew this was coming.
You prepared. Good.
I'm prepared.
Is there a ritual that you recall as a child that really contained you, held you, moved you?
So I've been thinking a lot about how to answer this question because what are we on, like, episode 20 now? And I hear people answer it and I'm like, what the hell would I say to that?
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the truth of the matter is I can't talk about my concept of ritual without talking about my upbringing and coming from an Orthodox Jewish family. I had everything in my life ritualized, everything, to the point where it was actually, it felt oppressive. Right. And so my relationship to ritual, religious ritual in particular, I didn't have a concept of non-religious ritual, but there was so much religious ritual content in my life that was sort of what was on my mind. And it could have gone in a very negative direction, you know, when I grew up, because I had all of these negative associations, sometimes traumatic associations with Jewish rituals. But when I think back and I think about why I didn't just sort of abandon Judaism and abandon my Jewish identity and say I never want to have anything to do with it, I think what it was that there were, every now and then, there was a ritual that wasn't required.
Hmm.
The one that comes to my mind from my childhood that really embodies this. Every year before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, two Jewish holidays in the autumn.
Yeah.
My father, my brother, and I, we lived in one of the ring settlements north of Jerusalem called Ramot. And across the valley is a place called Lifta. Now, Lifta is it's about a 25 to 30 minute hike from our home in the settlement. And you walk through this valley and you get to this place. It's an abandoned and destroyed Palestinian village. But unlike most of the destroyed Palestinian villages in Israel, this one still has quite a few dozen of the houses that are remaining.
Mm.
It's actually visually striking. It sits at the entrance to Jerusalem just off of Road 1. So just at the entrance to Jerusalem where the highway goes to Tel Aviv or to Jerusalem.
Right.
And it's sort of in the ravine there. And at the bottom of the valley in Lifta, there is a natural spring. And my father, my brother, and I would go there before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur every year to go to the mikveh in that spring. Mikveh is a sort of Jewish ritual where you sort of purify your body.
I think they know about it by now, I hope. Like those that have been listening to the Ritual House for a while, because I'm like all about mikveh. But yeah, I love it. Yeah.
And mikveh is traditionally more associated with women. In sort of traditional circles, but in the mystical and Hasidic side of the Jewish tradition, men also go to the mikveh. And my father was starting to get into Hasidut. And so mikveh became an important practice for him. But, you know, again, in that vein of a ritual that's not required, there was no one who would say that you have to go to the mikveh before Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. It's not something that's required of you. So it was something that I was just doing because I wanted to be with my brother and my father and have this incredible, beautiful hike and bonding experience and then dipping in the rich in, and you know, there's like moss at the bottom. This is like a very, very ancient kind of a place and it's open air and there's like random people walking in and out. And it being a whole body experience, I think also was something about it. Of course, later in life, it became fraught with my rising political awareness of the fact that there were 2,500 Palestinians who were expelled from this place.
Right.
But yeah, that's the ritual that came to my mind.
Mm, that's so beautiful. What a great plug for the Ritual House, because that's basically what we're doing all the time, is the like rituals that aren't necessarily obligated, we're obligated to, but the ones that enrich us. But I love that image. And we, I think, might have different perspectives on a particular ritual in Jewish life.
What could you be talking about, Tova? I have no idea.
Yes, we were talking about bris, brit, circumcision, which I actually think is really interesting, the language that one uses when talking about it. But I think the framing I want to hold for this conversation is, I mean, what do you do when you inherit a tradition that you love, which I know you do love, and I do love. And what do you do when you inherit one, and one of the most maybe pivotal, paramount, lifted up rituals, assumed rituals that one does, what do you do when you don't agree with it? Or I don't even know if that's the right language. You can use the language you feel. What do you do? And I think it's a really interesting question when it comes to ritual, because rituals are not always, you know, like the new moon circle I did this week with lots of flowers and candles and good smelling things. Rituals can also be complicated and hard and ancient and tribal. And what do you do with that? And so that's the question I'm asking as we're diving into this, even though we land, I think, on different landings. So,
yeah, no, I appreciate that framing a lot. And I think that's exactly right. And you're, as usual, going straight to the heart of a matter. We're not beating around the bush, as it were. You're going straight to the heart of the matter. And that's exactly what drew me to the topic of circumcision, of Brit Milah. And I think it's actually a really rich window into the exact question that you just asked, right? So for me, there are a lot of parts of the Jewish tradition. You're right, 100%. I am deeply proud of my Jewish heritage, and I see a lot of beauty in the Jewish tradition. But I also see a lot of parts of the Jewish tradition that that have caused damage in the world. And there are many areas of sort of religious or spiritual damage that I think we in the Jewish world talk about in a kind of open and critical way. And mm-hmm. one of the examples that I like to bring about, you know, the role of women was always something, ever since I started thinking critically as a teenager about the Jewish tradition, the role of women kind of stood out to me as like a real problem, right? So women in traditional Jewish law are not relied upon to be witnesses in the court system. Women are not allowed to divorce men, right? These sorts of patriarchal norms are kind of embedded in Jewish law. And to me, this is sort of like an obvious problem.
And traditional readings of Jewish law, I think, can we put that on there? Is that
Absolutely.
Fair to do? Okay.
Absolutely. Although I would argue that even in the more liberal branches of Judaism, in the conservative movement and the reform movement, there have been concerted efforts to deal with patriarchal norms that are, you know, I think, more successful than, let's say, in the Orthodox denominations. But I mean, I think you'd be a fool to look at even conservative and reform Judaism and say that, you know, they've managed to completely overcome those patriarchal norms.
Really? Are you sure? I mean, like, I, as a female rabbi, I am just shocked to hear that.
Well, I want to mansplain to you a little more about this.
You.
So if you would allow me to continue, Tova.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Yeah. So for you, just to go into it a little bit more, like, you do feel that there's been some real critical conversations around, let's just say, women's roles within Jewish life over time.
I do. And I think for the better, right?
Uh-huh.
Whenever, and for me, this goes all the way back to the beginning of Jewish history, actually. But like, whenever a generation of Jews is thinking about their tradition, they're always aware of the aspects and the elements of the tradition that are butting up against the moral concerns of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually, to me, like the engine of how Judaism maintains its vitality and continues to be relevant and like a rich source of spiritual growth in the world. So it's like, it's actually, we're putting our finger on the thing that makes it so vital and so beautiful and so important.
Right.
I do think that on the circumcision issue, because it's about genitals and because there's a taboo and a whole other host of reasons that we could get into, I think that the level of conversation around this topic has been much lower than around other topics of moral concern. And that's one of the motivating factors behind the work that I do on this and behind, indeed, the organization that I co-founded, Bruchim.
Okay, got it. So there hasn't been enough conversation about it. And you're here with you made a documentary on it. This is a passion of yours. I think when we met, it might have been the first conversation we had. And I was like, guess we're going to have very little to talk about, you know? And I'll just say, I have to be honest about it too. You know, as a woman, a female identified individual, I come from a family with sisters. We're three girls. I have two daughters. I actually have not personally in my own life have had to been close to making a decision or be in the inner circle until actually this year with a nephew that was born, but I was still a little bit more removed, you know, to brises, to circumcision. I mean, in fact, as a rabbi, I have done a million baby namings, simchat bats, brit bats, that's what I call it, because I like the term brit is, right, as you know, like it's covenant, right? And so I feel like if there is a covenant for little baby boys, well, there ought to be a covenant for baby girls. A brit bat, which usually includes a ceremony, a naming ceremony, and then covenantal blessings that we say. I actually, the first bris that I officiated was this year, and I've been doing these things for like at least 10 years. So that's really interesting to me. Like, I am a little bit more removed from this.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that I can't have like a thought on it, but it does mean that there's like a little bit more of a boundary or a distance than I have with this
yes.
conversation. So I just
And it's not something that was done to your body either.
Correct. Exactly. No, I mean there's a lot there. So I want to, like, I don't know, own that like piece and
yeah, Granted,
I counsel people a lot with this question that you're bringing up. It comes up to me a lot. So tell me.
Yes, absolutely.
When did you get into the, when did you realize or feel that Brit Milah, that circumcision, ritualistically speaking, was no longer something that you could get behind?
So it's funny that you bring up, and I think that's absolutely right of you to do, to bring up the fact that you have a certain distance from this that I don't and that other people don't. And the reason I say it's funny is because my first critical thinking about circumcision actually happened because of proximity. So by a complete sort of fluke set of events, I was given the honor of being the sandek at a cousin's bris.
Can you tell everyone? Yeah, tell everyone what a sandek is. Yeah.
The sandek is the person who holds the baby while he's being circumcised. And it's usually an honor that's reserved for elders in the family, very important people. And for some reason, and I can't actually remember why it was, I think maybe I had gotten into medical school and people were super excited about that. And so it was like as an honor for having gotten into medical school at the ripe age of 18 years old, you know, I was given this big honor of holding my my cousin during his bris. And so, you know, you grow up Jewish, you're going to have been to brises. You grow up Orthodox, you will have been to a lot of brises and sometimes in some proximity to them, but I was literally holding my cousin on my lap on this absurdly large pillow. And the mohel made the blessing and he cut my cousin's penis. And then he did something that I had never seen before, which is he put his mouth on the wound and he sucked. And then he came up and there was a dribble of blood on his beard.
Stop. Okay. Sorry. I'm so sorry. Like, no one could see my face, so I had to actually say my reaction. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but like, wow. Oh my gosh. I have never seen that, and I go to brises pretty regularly. Continue, please. Sorry.
Yeah. So for people, so I want to first talk about my reaction in the moment.
Of course. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Yeah.
No. And then I want to explain what this is because a lot of people may be shocked to hear that this is even a thing.
Yeah.
So my reaction was one of just complete shock. And it's specifically the image of the trail of blood on the mohel's beard that kind of stuck in my head. And I had been thinking critically about a lot of things in the religious tradition at that point. So this just became another one of those things.
Right.
And I mentioned that I had gotten into medical school, and fast forward to when I was in medical school and I learned how to read scientific papers, and I learned, you know, I did a course in medical statistics and I started understanding how to evaluate data. And I got curious about the claimed health benefits of circumcision. And I started reading a lot in medical school, just reading papers and papers and papers. And I very quickly realized that the medical benefits basically are just bad science, that there's a cultural practice that for a whole variety of anthropological and cultural reasons has persisted throughout time. And there are people who have tried to justify it via various different scientific methods, but basically the science is very weak. Now, what is this thing? What is this practice that I witnessed being performed on my cousin, on my eight-day-old cousin? The answer is a practice called mitzitza bepeh. Mitzitza bepeh literally in Hebrew means suction by the mouth.
By the mouth, yeah.
And this is a practice that the first evidence we have of it is in the Mishnah, which was codified in 200 AD.
Right.
Or 200 CE, mm-hmm. In the Mishnah in Shabbat, it's sort of mentioned along with some of the other medicinal, quote unquote, mm-hmm. medicinal practices to make circumcision safer.
I actually learned that Mishnah when I was pregnant, and I did not know if I was having a boy or a girl. And I was in early stages of pregnancy too, like meaning we did not want to know the sex of our baby, but also like it was early, no one knew I was pregnant. And I'm like reading this like ancient, right? And I'm like, my mouth is like open just the way that it was like when you were talking about it, you know, I just had this flashback to it. And I don't mean to interrupt you, but like it is wild when you read it in such a thing, right? In such a way, right? When you're experiencing, it's like in asking the question, wait, is that really a thing? Do we still do that? And of course, we talked about it being liberal Jews at a conservative, you know, place. That's rarely done. That's done in like really, really specific ultra-Orthodox circles. And it's like obviously wrong for X, Y, and Z reasons, you know? So it's just interesting hearing your story just because I really thought it was one of those, we closed the book. And I've been around a lot of Orthodoxy in my life with my family. So anyway, I feel like I'm really interrupting you, but keep going.
No, these are all important points that you're making here, because it is true that this practice is sort of relegated to the Orthodox. There are no liberal Jews unless for some reason they hire an Orthodox mohel, which is a separate thing. But generally speaking, you know, non-Orthodox Jews don't do this at all in any form.
Yeah.
And many Orthodox Jews don't do this either. Right. It's controversial in the Orthodox world for the very simple reason. I mean, aside from the fact that it's bad optics and that, you know, anti-Semites use this when they find out about it to attack Jews. But like setting that aside for a second, it's dangerous for the baby.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous because we now have this concept of a germ theory of disease, which didn't exist when this practice was instituted. And there have actually been reported cases of babies contracting herpes and dying as a result of this specific practice. Health authorities in New York have tried in many different ways to outlaw it and have failed at every turn. And so there are still mohels out there who do this, and it's a very controversial practice. But even in the Orthodox world, what you'll find is they'll still want to do some form of suction. So they'll take a sterile pipette, like a little glass tube, so that there's no actual direct contact. But yeah, it's still practiced in some places, and it's perfectly legal everywhere in the world.
So you have this experience, and I don't know how you would label it, but I would label it a little bit traumatic, maybe. Certainly, yeah, like really. And then you're in medical school and you're reading these journals, scientific journals, and you're sort of like, oh, I don't know if this like lines up right in the way that you thought it might. And then did you just say, okay, this ritual is not one that I like or I want to participate in, like from there? Or was it more of an evolution? Because I think for listeners that are not Jewish, which like, gosh, this is not all of Judaism listeners that are not Jewish. It really is not. It really is not. But for those that don't like know a lot, like brisses are like, that is like, it is one of the things that's really, or circumcision at least in for Jewish babies is not questioned. The question I get as a rabbi a lot these days is, okay, we're going to circumcise our child. Like sometimes it's like, I don't know if I want to do that. Right. And that's a whole other conversation that we're going to have. Right. But often it's, I want to circumcise our child because that's just what we do. Right? Jews, we do it. But I don't want to do the bris part. I don't want everyone around. I don't want a whole thing about it. Can I do that? So that's often my conversation, more often than the former. Although the former is happening more often than it used to. So for you, when did you say like this ritual is no longer one? And I feel like I should also share, I don't know if I shared this with you. I feel, this is a really weird thing to say, when I am at a bris, in some ways, I feel it's weird to me because intellectually, I'm like, ugh, what are we doing? Like intellectually, I don't think about it a lot, but if I stop and I ask, I'm like, what are we doing? Right? Like I do a little bit of that. I don't want to get close, right? Like if I'm the rabbi, I have to be. But like if I don't have to be, I'm cool being in the back. You know, I don't need to be in it. And weirdly, I feel this like weird Jewish mystical spiritual thing that happens to me when I am at a bris, even in the back. I don't know what it is. There are certain things that happen to me in Judaism that brings it out, and brises are one of them. And the one thing I can think about is when I've studied ritual is the higher the stakes of a ritual, like if there's like stakes that are high, obviously, this is a high-stakes ritual, right? Often, the feeling or the attachment or the connection is also, like, higher, right? They've studied this, right, with people. So, like, if the stakes are higher, then often people, not everyone, and I'm not suggesting that, like, there's some that are not, right? Like, we could talk about, like, what high stakes are okay to have and what are not, right? Which I think is what we'll talk about, but there is something that happens. And that's the only conclusion I can come from because I don't understand it. I don't understand why I would feel more like, oh, I'm Jewish when I'm at a bris. That's what I feel.
Okay. Let me try and take those one at a time, because there's a lot there to unpack. First of all, to your question about me and my process.
Yes, so tell me.
This is just the thing about me. I have always had incredibly powerful moral intuitions.
Oh, yes.
About everything and anything. When I was 10 years old, I had a very strong moral intuition about eating animals, and I've been vegetarian ever since. Right. And this is just true throughout many, many areas of my life. I feel moral intuitions more acutely than a lot of people that I know.
You don't live in the gray, Ellie, as I know you.
No, that's sort of generally true about my life that extends beyond moral intuitions as
no,
well.
But I'm saying with this, it's like when you find, we're the opposite in this way. I find the gray, like that's just my way. You do not. Like, you're like, no. In a way that's very boundaried. You know your boundaries on
that. Yeah. I mean, that's my experience of the world. It's not so much... I like to think I'm learning how to not project that onto other people, because I think that's actually really important to be aware of, like, what's a me thing and what's like a thing.
No, you're great at that.
And being able to distinguish between that. But yes, for me, like, especially around moral issues, like, I feel very strong moral intuitions about things, whether they're right or wrong. And in this instance, it just hit me like a ton of bricks. The visual, obviously, and the sort of traumatic nature of the fact that I was holding the person to whom this was being done amplified it, I'm sure, to some degree. But it was instant. It was, this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. And then it was like an intellectual process of like, well, why are we doing this? Mm-hmm. And what are the reasons that people give? And then sort of a bit of a shock, honestly, because I knew that it was a widespread practice beyond just the Jewish community. And I assumed that if, you know, this was being done to hundreds of millions of men around the world, or baby boys at this point, there must have been some kind of, you know, at least semi-solid scientific health foundation for it. And to learn that that wasn't the case, as I did, was actually quite a bit of a shock. But it also was sort of, it kind of added another really interesting layer to me, to this subject, which is endlessly fascinating to me. And I do have passion about it. It's funny, like when people hear that, like, this is because it was my first film, a lot of people know me in the world by this subject. And when people sort of first encounter me and want to talk to me about it, the question is never, why do you think this is wrong, right? I think everyone has a kind of, you just said it yourself. If you think about it for a second, you're like, what are we doing here? I think everyone has that. So it's not complicated to understand, why would I think that this is wrong? I think what people are confused by is, why would I spend and devote this amount of energy to it? Because in their minds, it's not wrong enough to justify that kind of, you know, passion, time, expenditure, focus. Like, I think for most people, their moral intuitions tell them that if this is wrong, it's kind of a minor infraction, a minor moral infraction. Mm-hmm. And so why would I make a feature-length documentary about it? Why would I co-found a group about it? But why would I find something endlessly fascinating in here to talk about?
Right.
Coming back to this point, like, you... and everyone who thinks about this understands intuitively, and again, this doesn't take a lot.
No.
That you're doing something painful to a person who doesn't have the ability to say no, and it's going to change their body for the rest of their life. I don't even have to get into anything else. And there are other moral problems that we should talk about. But just knowing those facts about this practice, I think anyone with a sort of rational brain is like, oh, I could see why someone might have a problem with that, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, to be clear, when someone comes to me and they're asking that question as a parent, I it's a very legitimate question. It's not an illegitimate question. Where you differ for most people is when uncovering the question, at least when they're coming to me, I try really hard as a rabbi to not have, like, try to give people the answer. Do you know what I mean? Like, that's my work as a rabbi, personally. I know other rabbis have their answers. I don't. I really try to meet the people where they're at and ask more questions for them to ask more questions, you know, to get to their own conclusion. Because I think otherwise...
Well, then let me ask you, Tova, how would you feel if someone came to you and said, you know, I'm having a boy. I'm deeply connected to my Jewish heritage, and I want to have some form of a welcoming ceremony, but I don't want to circumcise them. How would you feel about that? How would you react to that kind of a person?
Oh, I've done it before.
Oh, so say more. What have you done?
Someone did not, it was just one instance. They didn't do a it was pandemic. They didn't do a circumcision. They didn't do a bris. And then they wanted, at the year mark of their child, they wanted to do a baby naming ceremony of some kind. So I just basically did what I do for baby girls, minus any, you know, procedure.
Amazing.
I mean,
you should totally be on our directory.
Oh. I mean, listen, like, when they came to me, you know, I had to ask the question, like, how do I, you know, feel about this, you know? And my conclusion is, I want people to be Jewish, period. If they feel like they're Jewish, then they're Jewish, you know? And I want them to feel spiritually engaged. And, like, why would I not create a cool, creative ceremony for them? You know, that was just their choice. You know, I wasn't part of that choice either. I didn't know them at the time. And yeah, it was totally.
But you do know that there are rabbis who would refuse to do that, right? Like, you're aware that, like, for some people.
I think a lot of rabbis will refuse. We are trained in rabbinical school to say no. Yeah.
Tell me more about that.
I'm trying to remember because, again, like, it's weird. Like, I do a little bit of a block when it comes to bris, you know, because it's just like, I'm a girl. I don't know. Like, I just, you know. So that's why I said that was my first bris with my nephew, because this one didn't count as a bris to me. It was, and maybe it should count, right, to this point. Maybe it should count as a bris, right?
Totally. Like,
but for me, it doesn't. So that's, like, an interesting thing. To me, it counted as a lovely naming ceremony to, like, welcome someone into the Jewish community, you know? Like, but to me, it felt...
In which no one was harmed in the process.
I guess so, you know?
But you were saying before, and I do want to come back to this because it's interesting to me. You were saying that in rabbinical school...
Oh, the
they
training.
They taught you...
Yeah.
Yeah, they taught you that if someone comes and says, I want a welcoming ceremony for my child, but I don't want to do a brit milah, that you're supposed to turn them away. Tell me more about that.
I don't know if you're supposed to turn them away. I think our training is really complicated because I went to conservative rabbinical school, which means that we're operating from a halachic Jewish legal framework perspective. And we're asking the questions, what is Jewish law today? Really, that's the question. And how do we, as translators of that law, for people that generally speaking probably won't know, for the most part, the general population will not know Jewish law. They're going to rely on us to know what the Jewish law is. So how do we translate that? And I think when it came to talking about Brit Milah, we went into conversations about, like, why do we still do this? Like, what, like, let's talk about it as people that have studied it and people that are thinking about it and people that are going to have to meet people. And I think the conclusion was generally, like, yeah, like, this is something to do. Try to get them to do it, essentially. I don't know if I was ever told never welcome a Jewish family into your synagogue or into your community if they're not circumcised. I was never explicitly told that, but I would say the, like, behind the, like, underneath the current is just an assumption of get people to do it. That is an assumption, I would argue, in the world for Jews.
Right. And you wouldn't be surprised to learn that there are specifically conservative congregations that have a pretty punitive action towards families who choose not to do this.
It does not surprise me even a little bit. Yeah, no, of course. Like, I would say we face this, you know, at Jewish camps right now, you know, like, what's the, not punitive, not can someone come to the camp or not? Like, at this point, I think that's no longer feasible in California, at least, you know, given the fact that people are making different decisions, and especially in California, being, like, a more progressive state, I think.
So you're saying that because there's such a groundswell of Jews who are not circumcising their boys, that it's not feasible to deny those boys entry into summer camps?
Yeah, I don't think it's one kid per age group anymore. That might have been the case for a while. I think it's probably, it's not a huge population, but it's larger that, and I don't even think that one would ever, I guess shouldn't say whatever, but as far as I've been a rabbi or a Jewish educator, I can't imagine places that I've worked. I don't know factually, but my intuition would be no one would say that person can't come to camp, but there is social norms in bunks and how do you do, you know, all these are big, big questions that I think Jewish liberal world, conservative world in particular, I think it's coming to a head at this moment in time for all different sorts of issues, including circumcision. And again, I don't think there have been punitive sort of like your kid can't be enrolled here, but there's a social pressure or social sort of norms and like, how do you, and I think that applies there.
So Bruchim is an organization that I co-founded with Lisa Braver Moss and Rebecca Wald, who are two women who have been involved in the conversation about circumcision for a long time. We met through our kind of general work on this topic out in the world. And then we realized that there was a need for a Jewish organization specifically that provided a kind of advocacy for families who are making this decision. In other words, Bruchim is not an anti-circumcision organization. We actually don't take a stance on whether or not Jews should be circumcising their children, although we all have strong feelings about that. But as an organization, we advocate for the families who have already made these decisions, for them to be openly welcomed into Jewish spaces. And we've run into many, many families who have been alienated both from Jewish communities and from their own Jewish identities specifically around this issue. And what happened by accident after we founded the organization is we accidentally created a community where people who had been alienated from their Jewish identities, sometimes for decades, were finally able to feel comfortable as Jews. Thankfully, this is not common, but we have had situations where, you know, we've had to deal with families who have been punitively either pushed out of or publicly shamed for their decisions around this.
Do you think that's still happening today?
I do. And I don't have a lot of data.
Yeah.
So, but I can just tell you anecdotally from our perspective, it's a bigger problem in the conservative movement than in any of the other denominations.
Yeah, that makes sense to me that it would be the biggest problem in our movement because we're in, I don't know if it's our movement. I feel like I'm trans-denominational. I am pluralist. I don't know. But in my training, you know, and in my knowledge of how we look at things, because we do hold on to Jewish law pretty tightly, but look at it expansively, the question is, can Brit Milah just not be part of it?
Yeah.
I know your answer is yes, obviously, you know. And honestly, I should have studied more before our meeting. I did do a little bit of sort of deep diving into the spirituality of circumcision and Brit Milah, mystically speaking. I did a little bit of deep dive on that, which I find interesting, actually.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. What part?
No, all the Kabbalistic is really, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about the sort of concept of sort of integrating the sefirot, which are the, for listeners, just the energetic principles of Kabbalah, is that we are a tree of life. We are connected through different energies, and there's divine feminine, there's divine masculine, they intersect with one another, and there's different names for accessing the creator divine within ourselves. And it seems like, from my preliminary deep dive, is that, and I learned this a while ago, but I was reading it again today, is that mystically speaking, like Kabbalistically speaking, like with Brit Milah, we are sort of integrating those energetic principles more effectively.
That's a good summary. I think it's important to note, this is something that a lot of people don't know, but I think it's important to note that in the halachic side of the Jewish tradition, in the legal side of the Jewish tradition, what you were just talking about was the mystical side. Mm-hmm. I want to start by talking about the legal side.
I know, I should have done that, and I don't know why I didn't, so please.
No, it's okay, because we should talk at some point about the mystical side, but like on the legal side, this is so important because a lot of people don't understand this. So point number one, if you are an intact Jew, if you are not circumcised, you're a Jewish male who is not circumcised, you are fully Jewish. A according to rabbinic Jewish law and basically every single denomination on the planet.
According to rabbinic Jewish law, right?
You're absolutely right to draw a line between rabbinic Judaism and biblical Judaism, because the rabbis really...
Yes, it takes precedent. Biblical law often takes precedent.
But the rabbis completely revolutionized Judaism. And one of the ways they revolutionized it in was around this concept of the Jewish body, in which, you know, if for hundreds of years, you know, when, you know, Greek and Hebrew culture were in this very interesting kind of intersection, if for hundreds of years, the Greek body was the uncircumcised body and the Jewish body was the circumcised body, the rabbis say, no. There's such a thing as an uncircumcised Jew. And from that moment on in the Jewish legal tradition, if you're not circumcised as a Jewish boy, there are procedures about whose responsibility it is to circumcise you when you get to bar mitzvah, when you become an adult, and so forth and so on. And they discuss, you know, what are the consequences of leaving a Jewish boy intact? But you are 100% Jewish. So this, why am I saying this? This is super important because this it's one of those, like, things that people don't really understand. They think, oh, if I don't circumcise, my boy's not going to be Jewish. 100% not true in the legal tradition. So halachically, according to all denominations, an intact Jewish boy, if he's born to a Jewish mother, is Jewish. And in the Reform movement, if he's born to a Jewish father and he's raised in the Jewish community, he's Jewish also. In the mystical tradition, circumcision takes on this massive outsized importance. It's about uniting, you know, different parts of the sefirot, and it's deeply important. And actually, this is part of the reason, coming back to the oral suction of the circumcision wound, it's one of the reasons why the people who insist most on direct oral to genital suction, the mitzitza bepeh thing that got me started on this whole journey, are Hasidim. So Hasidic mohels in particular insist on it because for them, the suction through a pipette isn't accomplishing the same mystical things that direct oral to genital suction is. But you know what I'd love? I'd love to just sort of talk about your feelings about the ethics of it, and also, like, maybe using this as a bigger launching pad into the broader discussion of what one does when one sees an important part of the tradition in conflict with one's ethical ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was like right the original question. What do you do with that? And I think there's lots of different ways, you know, there's the way that you're doing, you know, which is sort of saying it's not ethical. So if it's not ethical, then we got to change it, right? I don't want to put words in your mouth, but is that kind of how you feel?
I do feel that way.
Yeah. What I like to ask is, what is the spirit of the law, essentially? I know that's not my only question. I think Art Green asked that question, who's, you know, a great thinker. Like, people ask that question, and that's something that I've come to for myself, because I don't want to throw away Jewish law. It's not like something I want to completely toss out. Reform Judaism has tossed it out. It's not bad. It's not my way. But what is the spirit of the law? And so the question, I guess, would ask with Brit is asking that question with that. And the way I do a covenantal ritual for baby girls is I wrap them in a tallit. There's other things I do. There's blessings I say. You know, there's different ways to do this covenantal sort of way. So for sure, surely that is an option. I'm not saying it's not, personally. And like I said, there is something emotional and connective that connects us to this ancient ritual going all the way back to Abraham, right? Like way, 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 way back. Your face is like, don't do it.
No, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but like, and you talked about this before, feeling something when you're in a room for a bris. And I just, like, I don't want to be like mean or rude or anything about it, but like, maybe what you're feeling is a cycle of trauma.
Yeah, it's possible. There's like a lot, there's a lot to like unpack. I think specifically today, being a human being and being a Jewish person today, right? For sure. And I'm in that. I think most Jews are since October 7th in some way, unpacking a lot of trauma. But
yeah, no, but I mean specifically about this practice. I mean specifically that it's a traumatizing practice that we do to our children, and then they do to their children, and they do to their children. And it's a cycle that specifically this practice. And I feel it when I'm at a bris. There's a weird, I captured this in my film Cut. In the, you know, I follow a sort of non-affiliated Jewish family who are about to have a boy, and then I go to the bris, and there's this, and I'm sure you have felt this too. There was a weird, uncomfortable electricity in the room. Mm-hmm. And when I say uncomfortable, what I mean is, I mean, it's supposed to be a joyous occasion, but when there's a bris involved, there's always something else. And that something else, I would posit to you, and that discomfort is that part of your brain that's saying, we're hurting someone right now. And you hear them screaming.
But I don't look at, I just want to say from, and again, like, I don't have as much experience with this in my lived body. And also, I am not a medical professional and I haven't read scientific journals, right? I will say, like, there potentially is for sure hurt. I will say, like, the screams that I, or the, like, tears that I hear at a bris, I hear when I get my kids their shots, right? Their vaccines. And I'm not saying they're the same thing. I'm just saying as a parent, there are a lot of moments where there is pain. And I really do see the ethical dilemma here. I'm not saying, I don't want to negate it or say like, oh, it's not a thing. Like, no, I see it. It's there. But for me, I don't know if it's there to the point where it's no more bris.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, we have so much more to talk about, but I have to still ask you, Ellie, a ritual that you are practicing or returning to today that helps you out. Do you have one?
This is going to sound really weird. Really weird. But
try me.
I have ritualized my engagement with social media.
Hmm.
And I know this sounds weird because I know for a lot of people, the idea of social media being any kind of a positive impact or influence in your life or anything having to do with anything spiritual sounds insane.
Mm-hmm.
But I, after October 7th, I decided to re-engage in social media on a regular basis, and I ritualized it so that every morning I wake up, I read the news, in particular about Israel-Palestine, and I engage. And It's a ritual in terms of, like, you know, I'm reading the news and I'm commenting on it. So it's sort of a commentary ritual. But throughout the day, it forces me to have very difficult conversations with people that I care about on social media about this issue that I care very deeply about.
Mm.
And to try and do it, and this is the tricky part, to try and do it in a nonviolent way. In a text-based medium. Now, you and I both did Newground, and one of the first rules in Newground is that if you're gonna have a conversation with someone, a hard conversation with someone about something that's, you know, politically explosive, get the hell off of text-based mediums.
Right.
At the very least, pick up the phone. If you're not gonna pick up the phone, meet with the person in person. And this is like one of the most important pieces of advice I could give to anyone, because it's still 100% true, right?
For,
like,
sure.
By limiting yourself to a text-based medium, what you're basically saying is, I'm throwing out all of the emotional cues that I would have even through a phone conversation, let alone in an in-person conversation, and you're increasing the chances that conversation is going to end up very poorly for both of you. But I am trying to be disciplined, and I'm seeing it as a creative challenge to engage deeply and with humanity through text-based media, like social media. And so every day after I've done my commentary, and inevitably someone gets triggered by it because I have contrarian views in the community that I belong to,
right.
I do my damnedest to apply the principles of nonviolent communication in a text-based medium and see how far I can get with it.
Mm. Wow, that's cool.
So that's my ritual.
Thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have not heard that one and I was not expecting it.
It's not easy. It is not for people who are getting their feet wet in nonviolent communication. Really, like, honestly, that original advice of, like, pick up the phone, get on a Zoom, or better yet, see someone in person. Like, if you care about the relationship, like, that's the way to do it. But I'm starting to discover certain kinds of techniques that can, and also, honestly, like, I want my social media pages to be places where people feel comfortable having good faith disagreements. And that's sorely lacking in our current landscape.
Yeah. So much more to talk about. I feel like we have to end just because of the time. But to be continued, as always, offline. But and maybe we'll have you come back on the Ritual House. I'm grateful for your perspective and for engaging this conversation. And please tell people where they can find you and look you up.
You can find me on Threads these days. I'm there a lot. E-L-I-U-N-G-A-R. You can find me at my website, ellieunger.com. Same spelling. Yeah, I'm around. I'm on social media a lot these days, actually.
Okay, great. Thanks for being here and have a good week. I hope you enjoyed that episode in terms of the discourse dialogue. I hope it made you think. As always, DM us if you have questions, want to engage with us more. Also, if there's guests that you're like really hoping to hear from, please also DM us those. We're looking for new guests for the second season. Really happy you're here. As always, we're going to leave you with a ritual. And I really loved the rituals that Ellie was honing in on in this episode. Specifically, I want to talk about the fact that it's spring and it's such a beautiful time to actually find a way to mikvah, whether that's going to the house of a mikvah, a ritual bath, which is beautiful, beautiful. I think a beautiful ritual. There's like a lot of layers to it, so it could not be the right one for you. So what I want to offer is there's a way to do mikvah like in an ocean, in a spring, in what we call Mayim Chayim, living water. And so my invitation for you is at some point in the next, before Passover, at some point, find a way to do some kind of mikvah. And it doesn't have to be the traditional way, meaning you do not have to dunk three times with the blessings in the particular way. If that is your way and you wanna do that, do it. I love it, it's one of my favorite things. But I want to expand this ritual because what is it at the end of the day? The end of the day, the ritual of the mikvah is to allow ourselves to be transformed vis-a-vis the energy portal of water. Water being fluid, water being the purest form of being able to be an, I like to call it the energetic cleanser. So my invitation for you is to find a way to find Mayim Chayim, living water, not a pool. I really think there's a difference in the living water part. Dip your feet in. Say a blessing to yourself of, I'm releasing what I need to release, or I'm honoring where I'm at, or I'm right here in this present moment. Again, you could say the three traditional blessings if you'd like, which is basically blessing Al HaTfilah, which is like saying I'm doing an immersion. The second blessing would be the Shehecheyanu, which is saying, I am here, Creator, divine, I got to this moment in time. And then the third one is the words of the Shema. But you could literally just go to the ocean and put your feet in and stare out into that beautiful blue and say a blessing to yourself and treat it as a ritual of some kind. That is my invitation to you. Try to find your way towards that before Passover in the next couple weeks. As always, I'm wishing you a week filled with attention and intention. I hope you take really good care. Lots of love. Thank you for listening to the Ritual House podcast. Please be sure to follow the show on whichever platform you are listening to this right now so that you'll never miss an episode. And as we grow the show, we want to hear about the rituals that are meaningful to you. We invite you to share your ritual practices with us. You can DM us at theritual.house on Instagram or find us on our website, www.theritual.house. Also, as a new show, your feedback is really important to us. Please head on over to Apple Podcasts and write us a review. And if you enjoyed this episode, why not share it with a friend? We'll see you back here next week to continue the ritual revolution. In the meantime, I'm wishing you a week filled with intention and attention. Take good care.